the show that connects businesses in Kent to do business. Tweet us live at Kent_biz.
Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us for another edition of Kent Biz Connects, the bi-weekly business radio show that connects Kent businesses to do business, hopefully, with myself, Martin White.
And me, Brian Wakefield.
Brian, welcome to the studio.
Thank you, Martin.
Another fabulous show that we've got lined up for our listeners. We've got some super guests with us, as usual, today. To my right, we've got...
Oh, you want me to talk now?
Please.
He's looking at me. Yeah. This is my first experience of radio. I really don't know what's going on.
Trying to find a way of doing it without actually having you talk, Nick, but we couldn't discover
Unfortunately, I could write it all down and then just email it to people later, like a sort of transcript. Yeah, my name's Nick Johnson. I've got two companies. One's The Image Works, which is a commercial photography business, and Immersive 3D, where we create 3D walkthroughs.
Welcome to the studio,
Thank
Nick.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
And next to you...
Well, it's lovely to be here. Anita Brightley Hodges from Family Business Place.
Anita, welcome to the show. And you've come adorned in some fabulous Halloween regalia today as well.
I went to the Farnham Christmas craft fair yesterday.
Farnham? What, Farnham. In Hampshire?
Yes, I'm sorry, yes. With some friends. I meet up with friends and we just, yeah, I just couldn't resist them. They're gorgeous, aren't they?
It's brilliant.
Skulls and...
It's a shame people can't see them.
I
so they're know, like right. pumpkin necklace yeah. and ghost earrings.
Yeah. It's very scary, Anita.
Well,
very scary.
You'll have to look at the post-show picture to get a proper look at Anita's fabulous earring and necklace. I must admit, I started Halloween a little bit early myself as well last weekend. I decided I needed to make pumpkin pie because I love pumpkin pie. But of course, what that meant was that having hollowed out my pumpkin and had candles in it for 2 weeks now, I think actually I've had it. It's gone a bit. Well, it's looking a bit sorry for itself. Squidgy. Squidgy's a good word. Yeah. So
not unlike yourself, Whitey.
A bit squidgy.
Yeah.
No, and nobody wants a squidgy Halloween.
No, we don't.
Well, I think we'd better move on, Brian. Don't you? I didn't realise it was going to get personal.
Purely complimentary.
Tell us what's happening in the business world in Kent this week, because there's always something going on, isn't there?
Yeah, there is, of course, yes. And, some weeks are more tragic than others, of course. But, we've got a couple of business snippets before we move on to our two guests. And as much as we try and avoid it, we're kind of back to that lovely mix of Brexit and traffic this week. So why is that, I hear you ask?
Do we call that Brafic?
Operation Brock, it's known in these parts.
Right.
Okay. So for those of you that haven't experienced it or even heard of it, but Operation Brock is something that's going to be put in place for, in the event of a no-deal Brexit, to cover us for the coming months and years. But it started this morning. So I don't think anybody's told the government that we're not actually leaving on Friday after all. So it's been delayed until January, and then that will get delayed until April, and that will get delayed until June, no doubt. But nevertheless, Operation Brock has kicked in this morning. We're supposed to have been done by 6 o'clock. So this is basically the M20. It's a contraflow system. So the M20 itself eastbound is down to one lane to take all the lorries, etc., down to your neck of the woods, Martin. They've all got to hang around in Manston until they find room on the 256. And then normal cars and normal people and normal businesses then join the contraflow to go on the London-bound carriageway. With me so far, it is confusing because I came down and I was in it and it was confusing. So there's one lane goes left, two goes right. In fact, there's two lanes that go left initially, and after a few hundred yards, one of those then comes right, which is really confusing. The different speed limits, so all the lorries are at 30, everybody else is at 50. So it's basically one lane coming down here, and apparently this morning it was supposed to have been in place by 6 o'clock. It was closer to 8 o'clock, whilst they put out, and get this, 7,500 traffic cones and 350 signs. So we saw some stuff online that a short journey kind of Walders laid down to Maidstone, which would be 15 minutes, is taking an hour, and Detlin Hill was about 50 plus minutes instead of 15. So it was chaos this morning, people turning around, going back. And that's going to have an effect on business, isn't it? Mm. It really is. So,
what do we think about that, guys? I mean, gosh.
What is the point of all that, I ask?
Well, I think it's a little bit silly that we kind of knew it wasn't happening Friday and it's still being put in place. I mean, I know obviously these things need a lot of planning and, you know, I don't work for the sort of highways agency, but you kind of get the idea that, and I mean, I'm assuming now, would they just go, well, no, it's not happening, so let's take that out now? Is it just going to be in place now till 31st of January? Do we know what's going on?
That's what you'd think. That's what I thought, is that it just wouldn't be in place because it's not happening.
Yeah. But will it stay in place now till the 31st of January when we don't leave again?
I'm getting that impression that it's just there to, because they're not going to keep putting these out and taking them back again.
Well, there's big concrete blocks, aren't they, down the middle of the motorway and stuff. I mean, it's not a 5-minute job to kind of put up and take down again, is it?
So no, it's really difficult for people. I mean, obviously, I came down, I think we live in a sort of similar place. So I came down that way.
We're all mates, though, aren't
we? Yeah, exactly. So. But from people who live in Ashford and sort of Folkestone and that sort of way, to come up into, you know, up into Kent and forward onto London is going to be really, really difficult, I imagine. And you're going to have to leave, you know, how long do you leave?
You can't pack those meetings all in a day anymore. We were talking earlier, weren't we, about sort of fitting about 5 or 8 meetings in a day. You can do that in London because you're on the underground, you know, and once upon a time you could do that in Kent. But now, you know, it's forcing us, it's going to, well, I think the smart ones just wake up and smell the roses, smell the coffee and be making lots of Zoom calls. And, you know, and I think that's brilliant, actually, because then, you know, there's no barriers then, is there? And I think technology is fantastic at being able to do that. I mean, I have so many Zoom calls with people around the country, around the world.
Perfect. Well, let's hope employers kind of look at it that way and think, do you know what? It's about time we kind of rationalised our business a bit more on that level anyway. Why don't we empower people to work from home?
Home, completely. This whole thing about flexibility, you know, it's here now. And my sister's just got a job, actually, and on her list of things she wanted to do was to have some flexibility and work from home. And actually, the business that she's working for now said, oh, and by the way, you can work from home 2 days a week because you know that's really important for you. You know, and business has changed so much now. You know, years ago, it was always, you know, it was all about performance and how much can you earn, how successful can you be. But actually,
and you couldn't leave the office before your boss did and all that
and for
kind
women,
of nonsense.
It was worse. But now, even men are saying, I'd like to see my kids. I'd like to do something after work. I'd like to have a life.
Depends on the kids, I think.
We're on the planet for 80 years, you know. And my business is totally flexible. All of my team work flexible, and they're all mums. So one works 5 days a week, 9 till 2:30. Another one does 2.5 days a week. I have a grandson. So myself and Amalia and Olympia, who's only 24, we work 4 days a week. And we have Hendrix for a whole day. And then your life just stops, slows down. You know, you've got a little minion that's like 3 years old.
Yeah. No, I'm all for it. But, I mean, Nick, you can't do that, can you? Because, you know, you're a photographer and you're on location.
Yeah, everything I do is all sort of event or you know, I have to go to where the thing is happening to me.
Can you do a lot of midnight shoots and things like that?
Not well.
It would be ideal, wouldn't it?
That would be lovely, yeah. Well, who for? I have to travel and 99% of the time I have to travel in a car because I've sometimes got a lot of equipment to take. And, you know, to be honest with you, the train from a lot of work I do is in London and from Maidstone where I am to London is really poorly served by the train. You know, I can go to Victoria. Brilliant. I don't think I've ever done any work in, but, you know, Victoria's...
Yeah, we've got about 6 railway stations in Maidstone, basically, haven't we?
Yeah, and they
all go to the same place.
I mean, if you want to go and see Wicked every day... Yeah. Brilliant, but you know,
you can't get on the high speed at Maidstone. You'd have to drive to Ashford, I guess, or Ebbsfleet, and then
or to Strood or something. Yeah.
What's and the point?
It's really expensive
every day for 25 years.
Yeah, but you can't.
Couldn't do that.
You
today,
can't. No, though, I don't think. You know, I end up having to sort of use the car more than I'd like to, really. But even that, you kind of always got to leave an extra. I mean, I kind of work out how long it's going to take me, in an ideal world,
and then
stick an hour and a half on it because you just never know what you're going to get, what's going to be in the way.
That's just so unproductive, though, isn't it?
Yeah, you take 3 hours out of your day, you know, and a lot of times I'll turn up somewhere and I'll be an hour early and I'm kind of going, well, now what do? I just sort of sit around and wait for the thing to happen. You know, it's just...
So what advice can we offer people? So, I mean, firstly, beware. it's out there. It's Brock is now in place again. But what advice can we offer people? Well, employers, you know, try and think a bit more flexibly in terms of not making your staff's life hell unnecessarily if they can work from home. But I guess, you know, leave extra time is the only thing you can say to people. Well, if you have to travel on the M20, you know, leave extra time. But of course, you know, that will now put extra burden on the M2 going into London. I'm sure a lot of people will be, you know, thinking about, should I cut through at Bluebell Hill or should I cut through on the A249 or whatever it is.
And all the other roads off and around it, of course, and because everybody's trying to do little shortcuts and rat runs. And apparently this morning, most of those were all snowed up as well because everybody had the same idea.
And just stressed out before you even get to work.
There is that as well.
I mean, it's huge, isn't it?
And also, you've got to think about the environmental impact as well. With lots and lots of people sitting stationary in their cars, and not everyone's, you know, my car doesn't have the stop-start thing where it cuts the engine out, and you're sitting there, you know, belching out fumes out when you don't need to be because there's not been maybe as much thought of it. I think maybe there just needs to be a lot of, with the highways, more discussion with local businesses to go, right, this is what we need to do. But how will this impact you and maybe what's the best way around for us to do this? Because you don't know how it affects people unless you spoke to them and you communicate with them.
Mm.
And I'm, you know, I know I'm only a one-man band, but my opinion's never been asked to go, if we do this, you know, I live at Junction 5. Mm. We've had the extra lane being put there for 2.5 years.
Mm.
Nobody asked me how that was going to affect me and my business.
Mm.
That I think that's something that I think a lot of government bodies don't do as well as they could do, which is just talk to you.
Well, moving on slightly from there, but kind of related, is there some movement on a large infrastructure project, Brian, finally?
Well, I was going to say, it's
on
moving
a more positive
on, but
note.
Only very slightly, actually, because it's the talk around the Lower Thames Crossing. Mm. So for anybody that hasn't heard of it, it's the kind of second Dartford tunnel / bridge, really, to basically get everybody from Kent into Essex, not through choice, of course, but sometimes
surely
one
it's
has
the other
to.
Way around.
Yeah, there you are.
People from Essex want to come to Kent. Yeah. Surely,
who would want to do that? But just occasionally, one has to.
Purely with the objective of avoiding London, I think.
Probably just to go up north, actually. Yeah, yeah. Occasionally, so it's more like going through Essex rather than to it, isn't it? But so basically, there's the Kent Essex thing. So this will be the second crossing that's going to kind of relieve all of the problems that go on with the bridge and everything else. However, it's no pain, no gain, isn't it? Because this is basically held up as the biggest change to Kent infrastructure since the building of the M25.
Really?
Oh,
the time? You've got the shed thing on that.
And no, because they keep mucking around with it.
And where is this supposed to be taken?
Well, I think it's coming across.
End, it?
Yeah, it's kind of Higham-ish, really.
Because
so
I knew that's where it was originally, across the marshes. I used to work for the KM in Dartford and Gravesend. And this was going on when I was there sort of 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And then I think it was changed, wasn't it, when our illustrious leader was mayor?
Yeah, there was three or four.
He probably wanted
options.
To do it from space or something.
But the point is, Joe James has come out and said that that Kent businesses are going to be in line for is it the lion's share of the kind of the work involved? Or
yeah,
not?
It's a case of capitalising on it, and there was an event just held recently here in Ashford, and so if you've got to go through all of this pain, then Kent businesses should get something from
benefit.
It at the end of the day.
That's positive.
So there's talk of Kent businesses maybe getting subsidised crossing charges and stuff like that, but also on the larger scale is that they're going to get help to get involved with the tender processes. There's going to be lots of work that's handed out, so it's only right, really, that Kent and Essex businesses should get a little share of that.
But this would only be a road. This would be a road bridge. There wouldn't be any rail infrastructure.
No bridge. It's a tunnel.
It's a tunnel.
Yeah, it's basically a tunnel with then some dual carriageway or or triple right. carriageway even. Lord knows how many the Dartford Tunnel is now. It's about six or eight at one point, but it's
well, there's two tunnels, aren't there? And there's two lanes in each tunnel, so...
It's the funnelling back in at some point, because unless it's going to stay eight lanes all the way round, which of course it isn't, then it's got to come back into six, then four, then three. So it's got a bottleneck back in somewhere, and that's where a lot of the problems are. So just again, to reiterate on the point we were just talking about, is that when that all starts and kicks in, it's going to be more carnage and chaos when...
On a particularly busy route up by Gravesend, because I drive up there fairly regularly.
Yeah.
And at 6 o'clock in the morning from Faversham onwards, it's nose to tail.
It's a slow M2, isn't it?
At Bluewater, you know, once you go up the hill there, it on the A2, it just grinds to a halt.
Because all the lorries are trying to overtake. Yeah. One's doing 10 mile an hour, so the one doing 11 has to pull out.
I'm assuming the disruption would only be with the link from the tunnel to the M2. When they're actually building the tunnel, that's if it's going under the Thames, then...
Well, that's what you'd like to think, isn't it?
But as
they're doing here, though, Nick, I think in Ashford, you know, there'll be a new exit road that needs to be built. Yeah. And, you know, so, I mean, it will be a lot of upheaval. But hopefully something positive. But going back to what Anita was saying, I think, you know, again, another reason for employers to think about, look, you know, what is our kind of traditional business model? Do we really need an office? Can we save a huge chunk of overhead by having a skeleton staff at the office and just providing somewhere for people to come and meet managers or clients?
I'm not really sure that would be the answer, because I think we need to be with people. You know what I mean? It's like good to go to work. It's good to see people, friends, to talk about stuff, hatch ideas and do deals, etc. So I think there's something in us all to want to come together somewhere.
Sure.
But thank goodness for networking events. That's what I say.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I won't say anymore now.
I said it for you.
Can someone pick that plug up and fly it or trip over it?
Because, you know, the flexibility has to... It's a culture thing. And one has to actually balance out the need for people to meet people, touch people, have a laugh, etc., with being productive. And that's really, really important. Mm. I think the other way around, say everyone just works from home, would be meaningless.
No, of course.
And terrible.
If it's anything like a big change, there's going to be those diehard people who won't want to change. And go, this is the way we've done it.
But that's about trust, isn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly, yeah.
You know, I don't trust you to work from home. No. You're not clocking
and,
in.
And not everybody can they? I mean, if you work on a production line or something like that, you know, when you can't make that widget at home.
No.
You need to be in a factory.
Yeah, there's only certain industries that we had to do. Yeah. But, you know,
a lot of assembly and stuff now, I think, is done at home, isn't it?
A lot of it is outsourced, isn't it?
Yeah,
you know,
it
is. That kind of piecework kind of stuff.
I think the thing is, if you're going to talk about flexibility, one has to decide, it's a good thing, how can we go about doing it well, rather than just all the barriers. Because I mean, this is the whole thing of like this tunnel thing. I mean, I lived in Hong Kong, so when they decide to run a tunnel through a mountain, just get it done, you know. And then it's great. You know, here we procrastinate about everything, and everything's just a mess. I mean, I love London, but I've been working in London for 35 years, and there are lovely buildings going up and down, but it's still in 35 years. Always looks like a building site.
Yeah, constantly.
Always looks like a building site.
It'll be lovely
site.
When it's finished.
Yes, quite.
It will never be, will it? It will never be.
No.
But the point is, I think, you know, what there isn't is any kind of bigger picture thinking in terms of how we can take vehicles off the roads, because that's what we need to do, surely, isn't it? We need to take traffic off the roads, not encourage more traffic on the roads.
So what does Elon Musk have to say about
that? That's not happening.
Doesn't he say take them underground, doesn't he?
Well.
And you just sort of like, bottom and just go underground and then, you know.
Yeah, that's a nice thought. I think the point is, with those two that we've got going on again, the Kent does only have two motorways. So we've got the M20 and the M2. Looking at this, they're both a little bit screwed for the foreseeable future with it all happening. Yeah. So it's going to get worse before it gets better. So I just think now is the time for businesses, really, business owners, to think, you know, we need to be aware of this and let's think. And I don't think it should be, right, you are now working from home. I just think if most people said, okay, you don't have to come in 5 days a week, you only have to come in two or even three, if everybody did that, would we not then have half the amount of traffic on the road, basically?
But then the other side of that would be if you only got to go in sort of two, maybe 3 days a week, you might maybe use the car 2 days, but then you might use the public, you know, a lot of people, the public transport is cost prohibitive to get into work. So you might use the train. So not only are you cutting back on the cars being on the road on the 1 or 2 days that they may be working from home, you also might take another day out of that because they go, oh, I'll get the train today, or I'll get the bus today, or I'll get whatever. So you're reducing it even more.
Actually, I don't need a second car. I'm going to sell it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Anyway, so sorry, people, but, you know, looks like the roads are going to be knackered for a few months.
Get a bike.
Yes. Yeah. I think poor old Operation Brock have got it in the neck now. So it's just they were unlucky that they decided to start it on the day of a Kent Biz Connect radio show. And it all took us longer to get here. But that was at 1 o'clock this afternoon. So it could have been worse. We could have been trying to do it at 8 o'clock this morning.
Absolutely.
Let's end our news roundup with some positives.
Oh, have we got some alcohol in there somewhere?
We've got alcohol and we've got Brussels sprouts.
Have we?
Yes.
What a wonderful mix.
Not in the same glass, I hope.
That'd
be good for you, wouldn't it? Party of five a day.
A little hors d'oeuvre of Brussels sprouts crisps to go with your sparkling wine. So the good news story there is Chapel Down have launched their sparkling wines in the US. So they are now an exporter to the US, and I think their wine sells for £50 a bottle out there, so $65 a bottle.
I was going to ask how many dollars is that?
Yeah. So congratulations to them. It looks like they've secured some distribution out in the US, which must be an incredibly difficult thing to do, I'd imagine, because wine is a very... it's a very sort of saturated market, isn't it? You know, there is... I mean, you only need to look at our supermarkets, which, you know, which are about a third of the size of a French hypermarket. But even walking around one of our supermarkets, the choice of wine today is just incredible, isn't
That's
it?
Fantastic
so
news.
Imagine going to the States, you know, with all their domestic producers and, you know, Californian wines. And
it's great, isn't it? By British. It's great.
It's fabulous, isn't it? British what a great brand. Story.
By British in the Napa Valley.
Yeah.
That's what I'd say.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So well done to them. But the other story sort of linked to that in our kind of joke at the beginning is Nim's crisps in Sittingbourne.
Ah, the fruity crisps.
The fruity crisps, but now also the Brussels sprouts flavoured crisps.
Fruit and
veg
crisps now.
Which they...
I'm assuming they are not crisps when you're you want to be eating while you're doing a radio show.
Well...
because I've got a cough button here, but I don't know if there's another one for the other end.
I think they're Brussels sprout flavoured crisps rather than actual Brussels sprouts that have been turned into
crisps. Well, thank goodness for that.
Here.
And actually, it's being marketed, this new range, as one of your five a day. So it's...
Really?
And in fact, we talk about Nim's a lot on this show, because I think they're just a fabulous success story. So they take a lot of their produce that goes into their kind of air-dried crisps, is all produced in Kent, obviously. Mm. And in fact, last Wednesday, when we did our After Six networking at the Ashford International, we had a local cider producer there called Rough Old Wife.
Oh.
And I hadn't realised...
I'm saying nothing.
you know, whenever we see these cider adverts on the telly, it's all positioned as a West Country thing. Yeah. But we actually produce more cider in Kent than the whole of those West Country counties put together.
Yes. Well, there's more orchards in Kent than there is anywhere else in the country.
Yes, we produce more volume here than they do there.
Well, I'll go to the foot of our stairs.
And have a bag of Brussels sprout crisps.
So I think there's also some other kind of flavours that they've got as well: beetroot, butternut squash, bubble and squeak, all sorts of stuff. So look out for those.
I understand the beetroot ones.
Nim's
really
vegetable
nice.
Crisps in your local supermarket shelves. And again, that's another, you know, it's kind of cutting down on all this unnecessary travel that we were talking about, isn't it? You know, it's kind of... You know, whatever it is, it's orchard to kind of, you know, to pack it, all kind
Just
of done locally.
Miles in the same county.
Yeah. So well done, you guys. Yeah. So we're ending on a positive.
Well, that's good to hear.
We're ending on a positive. Good.
Bravo.
Brian, we're 28 minutes in already.
Good Lord.
I think what we need to do is play some music.
A little bit of tunage to introduce our first guest.
By way of an introduction.
Guest the link. Best part of the show.
Guest. So that's what
we're
going to
do. I'll be looking forward to this when they're doing their smashy and nicey bit. This is just what it's all about.
Here we go. Mate. Here we go.
Can we sing along?
You're listening to Kent Biz Connect. Tweet us live at Kent_Biz.
Well, Brian,
you sounded a bit creepy there, Martin.
Can I go?
Was that scary?
You chose it, so
I did.
Enlighten us, please.
Well, that was a bunch of lovely ladies, a bit like our next guest business, really, called Sister Sledge. What a wonderful hit called We Are Family. So, and We Are Family is the link to Anita, because Anita is a shining example of a wonderful business, family business, working for family businesses. So,
Anita Brightley Hodges.
So nice to be
welcome.
Here.
Welcome.
Family Business Place. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
For the benefit of everybody listening, just tell us very, very quickly in your own words what Family Business Place is all about. What do you actually do?
So we're a membership organisation and we are national, we've got a national remit, and we're here really to support family firms and help them thrive, to network, to help them, offer them advice when they're stuck, because the nuances of a family business are such that it's always around communication where they have problems and succession. And the stats are pretty awful, and if we can do anything to help change that and network them and do business with each other, how amazing is that? And
right.
I love working. I love seeing my children every day at work.
So let me just explore that a little bit further. That you said the stats are pretty awful. Before we came on air, you were talking about sort of first to second to third generation and how many businesses survive. So just for the benefit of everybody listening, give us some numbers then, because it is quite scary.
We're a family business, so we're doing it for family business. There are 4.8 million of us in this country alone.
Family businesses.
Yes.
Good Lord. Wow.
60% of all private owned businesses are family run. That's amazing. Okay. So in Germany, they call it the Mittelstand. So it's really, really embraced in Germany. And if you think about all the big businesses in Japan, the car manufacturers are all family run. In France, same. Australia, the States, the dynasties in the States.
It's true,
they?
Actually.
But actually, media. In England, it's always played down, you know, as like a mum and pop shop. Mm-hmm. But we've got household names here, you know, like Warburton's, Russell and Bromley Shoes, if you like that. We have here in Kent, Jonathan Neame, Stevenson's Shepherd Rocket Neame. Horses. I mean, you know, they're made just the most fabulous things. Mm-hmm. Cook Food have about 60 shops and franchises up and down the country, all family run.
Keel Toys here in Ashford.
I didn't know that.
Business I know
Big
quite Jig well.
Toys I know, and they're family run too. And McNaid's, you know, so it's wonderful. But the research and stats, and this is why I started the business really, show that only 30% of all family businesses make it from the first to second generation, from the entrepreneur to the next generation. And then only 12% make it from G2, generation 2 to 3, and only 4 make it from generation 3 and onwards. Right.
So that's basically when dad and mum and dad, whatever, start the business, they then want to retire, hand it down to sons and daughters. Yeah. 70% of those basically fail. Really?
Or they sell out, or, you know, don't get passed on to the next generation.
Okay. You know?
So what are the unique problems then that come with a family business as opposed to any other type of business then? Because, I mean, I think generally the kind of the startup business failure rate is quite high anyway. So, you know, there is a high failure rate amongst entrepreneurs in setting up in business. But what are the particular kind of and the kind of the unique problems that family businesses face in that context then? What kind of sets them apart?
Okay, well, why don't we start with what are the great things about a family business? You know, the thing about working with your family is there's an immediate sort of the whole idea about trust. You trust your family first, okay? It's just something you've got. Mm. So that is wonderful. Mm-hmm. And you stand shoulder to shoulder when the times are hard in your family. You do all those things, don't you?
Yeah.
And that happens in business too. But when other things get in the way and scupper them, which are only unique and nuances of family firms, it's all around communication. Mm. Okay, so when you're at work and you have a row with your boss, or you know, you're having a bad day or whatever, you go home and then say to your partner, your friend, you know, I hate it there, and your partner will say, I'll make a cup of tea, and you can tell them all about it. Or why you've always moaned about it? Why don't you just leave and get a new job? You know,
right.
You can't actually dispose of your family in the same way. Mm. Because
they're around for dinner tomorrow
they
night.
They are indeed. Mm. Weddings and, you know, all that sort of good stuff. Mm. And so the problem is two, really. One is communication. It's hard to talk about difficult things to your mum and your dad or your brother or sibling or cousin around things about money or pressures in the business or what's happening in the market and what are we going to do next. And, you know, and all of those normal things that happen in a business, you say them in your family in your family setting, and then you can't stop, you know, so you take it home with you. And not having those boundaries is something that, I mean, we have boundaries in ours. And when we close the door at family business place at night time, I revert back to mum and then my kids, you know, and at the weekends I do those things. But many family businesses can't do that. And so that's one. And the other is, we call it governance, but basically the way business is done, you know, the way the family organises itself to run as a business. So the work that I do is all around helping families to move from a family business into a business family, okay? And that's the key, really. Mm. In all family businesses are based on conflict.
Mm. Nick, you go.
Yeah, I'm really interested in the first point you made about, you know, when you close the door, you're not business anymore, your mum. How do you help other businesses to put those sort of things in place on a practical level? How do you, if you've got a, you know, two partners who run a business, how do you help them with that?
I can't fix family businesses for sure, but what I can do is just lay out really a sort of a blueprint for how a family business can exist in a thriving, fruitful, happy way, and then I can work with family business to help them with that, but I can't take them there unless they're all prepared to come.
Right.
And because if you've got an autocratic family, a head of a family business, they're not going to want to listen to someone like me necessarily. Mm-hmm. So it's really about the family's willingness to change the way they've always done things and their openness. Mm. And I think that comes from education, talking about it, sharing these experiences with other family businesses where it's worked, you know, when it hasn't worked. And that's an ongoing dialogue all the time.
And that's a sort of a key pillar of what you do, really, isn't it? It's very much about community and actually sharing other people's first-hand experiences of running and being part of a family business with other family business owners, so that, you know, they understand, I guess, that the problems aren't unique to them. Other people have faced these problems, and this is maybe how they've overcome them. And but you focus very much on the positives of, look, if it could be, if we could just do this, think how wonderful it would be, I guess, rather than the negatives.
Always. And we, you know, you just have to say, when can you think of a time when you all got really well together? What were you doing? You know, what is it you cherish more than anything else? Well, then we work backwards from that, really. But you can't be naive about it, because if you have entrenched, toxic, familial relationships, then you've got to unpick that, or you've got to park it somewhere and move forward. You can't live in the past, but we are the sum total of our experiences, and we are the sum total of our parents. And if you have an entrepreneurial head of a family business, it's quite hard for the next generation to fill those shoes. And for parents to let go enough. And with the advent of technology, you know, our kids, my kids know more about technology than I can ever know. But I know that. But there are a lot of family businesses that don't like the idea of the next generation knowing more.
You know, they won't change in a lot of instances.
They find it quite hard to change, yes. And all family businesses think they're the only ones in the world that have these problems. It's like being in the air, you know, hello, my name is Anita, I'm a family business, you know. So we want to change all of that because it's great.
So you mentioned Family Business Place being a membership organisation. So what are some of the kind of the strands then, that, or some of the kind of the tools and kind of mechanics that you use to help overcome some of these problems within that within that context?
Okay, so we provide opportunities to meet together through our events. We have a fantastic two conferences, and then we have a wonderful National Family Business Awards. 400 family business guests descended on Wembley, because we think it's a place of champions. So everything about is upbeat. We also then have, as part of the membership, we have as an ongoing platform for training, for sharing experiences, for knowledge, etc. As a member, you can access all of those. And then we also have an advisory part to that, which is the work that I do, and I work on a one-to-one basis with family businesses that are just going through difficult times of change, and they just don't know where to go to next, and they love each other and they want it to be better, but they just can't. You know, it's always easier when you have a third party, isn't it, when you go to marriage guidance counseling,
fresh pair of eyes,
etc. And and we want family business to know that. But actually, family business, doing business with each other, we network our family firms together too. So you could be a cider maker up in Hereford, and there might be a little microbrewery down in Kent, you know, and you can share that wisdom, you know, it's wonderful. Or you might want to get on board with some technology, and you can't afford it yourself, but you might find another family firm in another part of the country, and together you could form a cooperative to get on board with, you know, taking up some new technology to share. Right.
I guess it's really handy if there's someone in the organisation that have experienced similar challenges to what someone else is doing now, and it's good to get together and say, well,
without a doubt.
How did you overcome it? What did you change? How did you do it?
And very often in the work that I do, there may be a point in that project that I'm working with a family, and I'll say, right, I think we need to meet so-and-so and so-and-so. She's been there, done it, seen it, come through the other end. And I can do that. And the big established family firms, you know, really are so generous, and they'll say, yeah, I'll come and talk to them.
So you would be aware of who else has been through that, because you've helped them through it anyway.
Oh, yeah. And also, over 10 years, we've made a lot of friends. And it's personal. Like, not like in a corporate. You know, everything you do is a personal gesture.
But like you say, communication is at the heart of this, I would imagine. And it's very difficult for, you know, first generation dad, for example, who perhaps has been quite autocratic in his style in the past. And, you know, maybe he has a son or a daughter working in the business, and they've never felt empowered to... Mm. You know, to have a voice, if you like, in the business. And I guess by by showing them other businesses that have kind of gone through similar problems, and more, most importantly, showing Dad that, you know, actually this was a business just like yours. Mm. And now it's thriving with the second generation that have taken it over. It helps to open their eyes a bit in terms of the possibilities.
And convincing him that he actually needs to change. Mm. He might not think he does at the moment, yeah. But...
It's quite interesting because there is a male and female part of this too. So when we're talking about a male entrepreneur and think about the next generation, you often hear this sort of murmurings of, they're not good enough. Mm. They're never going to be good enough.
Yes.
Mm. No, because they're not me. And then, but a mother would say to their children, I wonder if they'd like to be in this business. Is it worthy of them, really? So it's very, the sexism is quite a, it's quite a huge thing, you know.
Because we were talking about that Sky series, weren't we, before we came on air. I can never remember the name.
Succession.
Of it. Succession, yeah. And that's exactly it, isn't it? You've got the kind of the dad. You know, it could almost be a sort of a Murdoch company before it was sold off recently. You know, Dad's sort of dictating everything from the top, and he's clearly not convinced that any of his kids could run that business.
But don't forget, family business is the oldest business model on the planet.
Yeah.
And it's the biggest model around the world. Yeah. Because in the old days, you know, you were a blacksmith and you were a baker, a butcher. They were family businesses, you know. Mm. And it's...
It was sons, wasn't it? And daughter. Yes,
That's right. Mm-hmm. But I think also now we do have the, you know, we have the ability to be able to look back. I mean, I'm a baby boomer. Mm. So, you know, a baby boomer is described as someone that was born in the end of the 50s, beginning of the 60s, after the war, with a new optimism. You know, a lot of entrepreneurs, you know, are my age, mm-hmm. you know. And then you've got the millennials, which is my daughter's age, Amalia, and the first generation really to have a laptop, you know, as a normal device. And then you've got the next generation after that, and they're the first generation where, you know, where everything is available, you know, by some sort of technology. Mm. My grandson is 3. Mm. I mean, good grief, he knows how to use a fire stick.
Which division is he running?
Completely. But I think also I think it's all cyclical, isn't it? With the advent of large corporations, everyone's idea of success was to get the top of that. You know, when I grew up, I want to be part of a big corporation, a bank, insurance company, or a car manufacturer, or something really, really big.
Yeah,
and
as a board director or
that's
whatever,
right. And they could afford to pay you the money you need to say this is what success looks like to me.
Yeah,
but because of the way things are happening now. Mm. Those large corporations are saying things like, we'd like to behave more like a family business.
Right.
Can't do that because you're not. And because family businesses are always based on sacrifice and service. Mm. I sacrificed everything to set up this business and I'm here to serve you. That's it, really.
Yes.
And large corporates can't do that.
Because they're beholden to shareholders and the city.
Not just that, but you'll find that in large corporates, people move around very quickly. Mm. They might say 2 years, 5 years, 10 years and move around. Mm. In a family business, you're there.
You don't.
Yeah. You don't do that.
What I'm interested in, and you've probably got a lot of experience of this, is, you know, we're all in business here and we're in business. We don't work for somebody because we want to do it for ourselves. And that's one motivation. I'm interested in this sort of family dynamic of, if you're in a family business, you're not just doing it for yourself. You're doing it for your partner or your cousin or your uncle or your son or daughter, whatever it is. How does that create more pressure on people because they feel a responsibility because they've got to give it? Or is that shared kind of goal, does that make it easier?
That's a good question, Nick. So there are, I think, 5 reasons we know why you would join a family business, your family business. One is because your name is above the door.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's a responsibility. It's cherished. If you think of someone like Shep and Neem here, they're a really big established part of the community. They don't just employ people and make beer, whatever. They're actually part of the soil,
the fabric,
the DNA, the fabric of Kent. Mm. Yes. Mm. So
since 1698.
Completely. And then you.
Roughly.
So one is your name is above the door. The second is that you rely, if you come out of that family business, your parents no longer have access to a standard of life that they had when they were working, because it no longer exists. The third bit is you don't have access to the funds that were generated, the profits, etc. And then the fourth reason is because, you know, that you're joining us because you have a passion for it. Mm. You're passionate about the business because, you know, gosh, it's a delight when you see other children who just come in the holidays and they work with you, and you know, whether you make coaches and or whether you're on a farm or you make stuff, a lot of them are makers, will just come in and have that lovely, lovely, oozy, gorgeous atmosphere, which is, says happiness and challenge and expectation and, you know. And the other is because you can't get a job anywhere else. So as long as you know where you are on that scale, then everything is possible.
Right.
Because then you need to know is, okay, is it genuine? Can I get from A to B? What needs to happen in terms of education, experience, aspiration, and be honest. And there's a certain amount of self-awareness that needs to come in that. Now, you can't do that within your own family business because it's painful to say to your son, you really aren't cutting it, you know. And or to say that your youngest child has the leadership qualities that your eldest doesn't have. You know, so all of those things, everything you can ever imagine are part of the conversation.
And then obviously there may be, you know, a member of the family who doesn't want to be involved in the business, and that can obviously cause, I imagine, sort of problems within the family as well.
But that's when you, where you were talking about, you know, having the a clear boundary line between family and business is so important, isn't it? Because at the end of the day, first and foremost, we are family. And when we're at work, though, you know, we are a business family as opposed to a family business.
It's symbiotic, isn't it? The wealth created and the productivity created from the business will look after the family, won't it? But the family's well-being will have a direct impact on the productivity or the success of the business. But those boundaries are really important. And the work that I do, I call it protecting the family in light of the business. You know, so that's, and I always say, and people laugh, but I always say, you know, you can always get another business, you can't get another family.
No.
You know, and that's really important.
In some cases, that might be better the other way around, mightn't it? All depends on the family, surely.
It does indeed.
So, again, going back to, you have a fabulous website that kind of talks about the benefits of being a member of, of your family business place organisation. How many members have you got up and down the country? Because you're talking sort of in the hundreds, aren't you, I think?
Well, we've only recently launched the membership. We've been going membership about 5 months now. We've got over 100 around the country.
So before that, was it more coaching focused with you working one-on-one with business owners?
Writing stories, publishing the magazine, networking our family business together. I do a lot of seminars and speaking at conferences or private dinners. You know, wherever anyone wants to talk about family business, I'm there.
So you are the go-to person.
I'd like to think I'm a good ambassador for family business. I'm passionate about it, and I really believe in it as a fantastic way of earning a living. Because these days now, what we're saying is it's cool to be a family business. You know, a lot of family-run firms have global reputations, so they are going to be attracting the best caliber of person. But you don't have to get on a train every day. You could cycle to work. You know, you can have all those other good things. You can have both now, because I think family businesses are now just beginning to realize that they are important, powerful, worth it. And I think we've done, over the last 10 years, we've done so much work on saying, be proud, nail your, you know, yourselves to the mast and say, I'm proud to be a family business. And then you'll attract the best people.
And in terms of where you take that, it's really just down to your ambition, isn't it, presumably? Yeah. Because as you say, you could be a global powerhouse as a family business. You know, it could be a media company, for example,
like
News International before it was sold recently. Or you might just be a small cottage kind of industry producer, you know, locally.
You have to decide what's important in your life to you and your family. And then you know, your business will grow and mushroom around it. But you have to make sure your values are there for everyone to see and agree with. And you attract those people that share your values, whatever they are. You know, it's not about the job title first. It's about what is it you want. And we always talk about people's potential, don't we? It's great to work with people that are interesting, that are fun, that are conscientious, you know, self-motivated, all that sort of stuff. But actually, the other side that that corporates can't share with that family business do is, they can't share those values because they're meaningless. You know, at the end of the day, family first.
And, yes, they're just words on a PowerPoint presentation as opposed to you don't live it and breathe it. You know, it's not.
And not everything,
it doesn't come from the heart.
Yeah, and not everything that family does is about the bottom line.
No.
You know, it's about welfare. It's about trust, but it's about helping the business community. Yes. It's about helping each other, supplying to each other. Yeah. And if you think about the brewing industry, it's quite normal for you to be part of a brewing family and then go and work in another brewing family for 5 years or whatever, then come back.
Yeah.
As in construction, it's quite normal to go if you grew up in a construction business, to go somewhere else and learn the ropes, then come back.
Bring that experience back into the business.
Mm. And we've been really lucky. We've been able to provide work experiences for family, next generation families to go into other businesses and just see what it's like to work in a really great family business and then bring some of those ideas into your own.
Yeah.
So it's all, you know, this collaboration is just fantastic.
Yeah. There's lots of examples, aren't there, when you start thinking about it. And Gearing's in Ashford, for example, is another. You know, I know Adam and William. And again, they're second generation. No, actually, no. Probably third or fourth generation, I think, now. They've been around for a very long time. But Shep and Neame is a brilliant example. When you talk about a business being at the heart of a community, because you have the Hop Festival in Faversham every year. And I would imagine Shep and Neame started all of that because, you know, they are Britain's oldest brewer and, you know, and they are based in Faversham. So, you know,
but if you think about someone like Penshurst Place, okay, so I think Penshurst Place is about 28 generation or something like that. Oh, certainly Lullingston is. That's Tom Hart Dyke, the 28th generation, I think.
Yes.
And of course, they are the places, the estates, the buildings, you know, you pay to go and visit them because they're so gorgeous.
Yeah.
But they're really a money pit.
Yeah,
so they have to work as a business in order to survive. And I think people think that if you've got a landed estate, you must be doing all right. But actually, it's a money pit. And if you can't make the land work,
they wouldn't like the maintenance bill, would they?
Absolutely. And people forget that. You know, they forget all about those things. But you're actually really important to keep that land, you know, in the family. And it says something about your legacy. And I think that's the other thing about family businesses that we don't talk about in corporates is I really bang on about legacy. You know, many, many, many family businesses in the UK here are immigrants. You know, if you think about a lovely, iconic brand, Fortnum Masons, they were Canadian immigrants.
Yeah.
You know.
And now, look at New York. I mean, you know, everybody was an immigrant in New York originally.
You know,
so,
Irish or Italian.
Carnegie family, Scott, you know, steel, I mean, everything. Railroads, you know, they were all, actually, most of them were from this country.
Yeah.
And they wanted to provide for their family, do a good job. Mm. And, you know, I know a family business that's fantastic called Sunmark. And it's Lord Remy Ranger now. He came over to this country with 20 quid and a typewriter back in the 70s when having a brown skin was actually the butt of ridicule. You can remember the TV shows next.
Mm.
Now he has a £400 million turnover. Mm. He exports British goods over to places where you wouldn't want to send your goods. A bad day at the office in Syria or Egypt or, you know, Mongolia or whatever that's got conflict going on. You know, it's very different from a bad day at the office here, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm.
But, absolutely. You know, he employs other migrants and other cultures. And I think embracing other cultures is a really significant part of the makeup of family business. Mm. I mean, I'm half Chinese. The first Chinese takeaway opened in the 50s in Manchester from a woman whose parents lived in China, escaped from China in the soy sauce wars, then came over to England, went to Hong Kong, came over to England in service, were given a pardon to be free people. Then, but while she was coming over on the boat, she was cooking curries and they loved it. Mm. So when she came to England, she opened up.
Wow. She had a business.
She had a business.
Ready to go.
And her clients were the Beatles and all sorts of, you know, people that were around doing their thing at nighttime. Well, you know, and if you think about Indian food, it's a heritage. It's
a staple, isn't it?
It's a staple.
Yeah, very much
The Turkish food. I mean, we've got one up the road here, which is just brilliant. So there's a lot to be said for bringing cultures. Mm. And, you know, I'm half Chinese, so my mother was Chinese and escaped from communist China to Hong Kong with her seven siblings when she was only 11. And but the Chinese will make it and sell it, and if they can't make it and sell it, they'll cook it and sell it. So it's in our genes to work hard and just to survive, really. But and it does make you a very determined person as an entrepreneur.
But the interesting thing about both of those you know, both the Chinese though and the Indian, you know, or Bangladeshi, you know, as a lot of kind of curry houses are, and corner shops and all those types of businesses, is that work ethic. But first and foremost, they are a business.
Yes.
And they understand that. They are there to make money.
Mm.
Because yeah. any business that doesn't make money isn't going to be in business for very long. And so, you know, everything else has to fit in with that, I guess, doesn't it, at the end of the day? So.
Yeah, it does. But, you know, if you loved the family business you worked with and they treated you really well, so if you needed help with your family, someone was ill or, you know, one of your children was ill or something happened, you wouldn't say, well, OK, you can make that time up later.
No.
Or I'm going to dock your pay, you know. And so that's a given. And that is repaid 100-fold when you're up against it, because all businesses, you know, it's hard running a business. Mm. It's hard. Mm. And, you know, when you're up against it, if you're in a family business, they will stick with you because we're all in it together.
Mm.
And I think that sincerity and that personal touch, that real... I just, it's unique.
Fantastic. Anita, we could talk about this all day because it is a fascinating subject.
I think we should just keep going. Forget
really
my bit. Let's just keep going.
Like that.
I think it's absolutely fascinating.
So let's assume that, you know, we're a family business out there. We're listening to the show live or on catch up. And we need your help. How do we get in touch with you? How can we call upon your services?
Simple. You just, our website is familybusinessplace.com. And our whole team, we're only about six of us, but you'll get to know all of us. And whatever it is that you need, whether you're thinking about selling your business, whether you're talking about family dynamics, or you need investment to grow it, whatever faces you, we will be able to help you and know someone that can.
Fabulous.
So contact us there. And you know, if you're a family business and you just want to know more about it, then come on one of our Discovery Day workshops.
Brilliant.
For families to just meet for one day and really get to grips with this fantastic organisation that they have.
So everyone will find you online, won't they?
If
they Google search Family Business Place.
Family Business Place. There you are. Nick, you had a very
quick
question.
Yeah, I just
want,
what is... What would be your criteria for a family business? So what criteria do you need to meet to be able to sort of become a member?
They're they're husband and wife or two members of a family business that genuinely are in business together.
So it doesn't need to be a generational thing, it's just two
doesn't
members.
Have to be a generational thing. But what they have to be prepared to
husband
do
husband and wife.
It could be husband and wife. Mm. Well, we're lots of family businesses are husband and wife. You think about the body shop, that was a husband and wife. You think about the white company, that is a husband and wife team, you know. If you think about Joe Malone, they were a husband and wife team, you know. So yes, there lots of them, and they need to be active in the business. Okay, but the reason we can help them is when they're thinking about the future. So if they're going to look to the future, think about exit, succession, growth. That's when we can really, really help.
Mm-hmm.
Brilliant.
Fantastic.
Come networking at BBM Maidstone and meet Anita in person.
Other networking events are available. Anita, thank you so much for that. That was absolutely wonderful. We are going to have to leave it there because otherwise we won't have any time to talk to Nick. And
have anything to say.
We are desperate to talk to Nick as
very
well.
Very, very quiet.
So we're going to play a little bit more tunage by way of an introduction to our next guest, and we will see you on the other side
the
of
other side.
This. Wow, there's a blast from the past, Brian.
You nearly cut my mate Debs off there in a prime.
Debs.
Yeah. Debs. So, yeah, that was a wonderful, marvellous Debbie Harry and Blondie.
Yes.
So that was a track off of the album, I think it was Parallel Lines, 82, something like that.
I had a copy.
But, everyone had a copy. Wonderful. I think. Everyone a hit. But yeah. That was called Picture This.
Picture This, which I think serves as a fantastic
There's a little bit of linkage.
Well, man, to our next guest.
Nick Johnson.
Who knows?
Nick Johnson from Immersive 3D. Nick.
Yes.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's lovely being here.
It's lovely to have you. Tell us, Nick, Immersive 3D. That's tell us what that actually is and what you actually do, because most people probably know you as a photographer.
Yes. So I've been I've been a photographer 32 years now, I think it is, and we're doing lots of different types of photography. But the Immersive 3D thing. So we're reasonably new. We started around about this sort of time last year. And it's a very difficult thing because it's incredibly visual. So I don't know if radio is the best medium for it, if I'm perfectly honest with you. But
it is if you've got a face like Brian's.
I will.
Radio's perfect.
Very much so. I mean, I'm glad we made him wear a bag over his head for this whole thing, because it would just have been too much otherwise. So basically what we are, the best way to describe it, we are a reality scanning company. So we produce 360-degree 3D virtual digital twin is another. There's lots of different terminology, and it's that sort of thing where it's just trying to say this, a thing that people understand. If you can imagine from walking through a space, a building or something like that in a virtual way. So you can do it with VR goggles on, or the best way to do it is view it on a tablet or a phone. So what we do is we go and we scan the whole area. So say, for example,
a holiday villa.
Yeah, exactly. So a holiday villa. So maybe it sleeps three. That may be 60 to 70 different scan points. And each one of those scan points, you can do a turn, if you like, and see it in 360.
As if you're standing there.
The additional part of that is just with the one scan, we produce the 3D tour. And then you can also produce floor plans, still photography and video, and also something called cloud point data, which is what the construction industry is really useful for them. So, for example, we've done quite a few progress ones. So we'll go in and they'll say, this door's in the wrong place. So rather than it being then sort of 3-4 weeks down the line, they can correct it before it's gone wrong. Also,
we're
talking about traveling as well, about reducing traveling. We can go and scan somewhere. The building site may be in Kent, for example, but the construction company might be in Manchester. They haven't got to have three or four people come down for 3 days with the cost, the traveling, the environmental impact there. We can go there and everyone can sit, as you were saying about Zoom calls, but they can all sit in there, have a conference call, look at it on a big screen and go, that's wrong, why is that there?
And then you can append notes to those images, presumably,
so in
real time.
And you can put little data points in, which you can then put anything in. So it can either be a still image, a video, links to YouTube. It could be a PDF. Say, for example, we've done a couple where they're used as what's called O&M manuals, so an operation and maintenance manual. So this particular one was for student accommodation. So you've got people leaving home at 18, 19, might not know how to use the washing machine, might not know how to turn the heating on or whatever. So there'll be a little data point and we put in a little YouTube video going, this is how you turn the oven on.
Clever.
I mean, we're on radio. I'm actually demonstrating it.
We're doing the turning
Nick
knob.
Nick's turning the oven on,
for the benefit of viewers at home.
Seems slightly pointless. But
could you turn it down a bit?
It's getting
a bit
warm. Drift, right? So, yeah, and you can put anything in there. So anything that's going to aid someone to be able to view the space, see the space, interact with that space.
So it's incredibly versatile. It has loads of applications, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
From development, property, building development, through to holiday rentals or buying a property. I mean, it's massive.
There's huge, and the more we've sort of looked into it, I mean, we've done a lot of. I mean, you know, we didn't even really do a scan for the first 6 months. We were sort of looking at it and seeing how the tech works and looking at other scanners. So there's one central piece of software which we use, and we use sort of three or four different scanners around that, depending on the level of detail, whether it's externally, internally, and what the end user wants. If you just want a tour because you've got an Airbnb that you want to promote, then it's the very simple. You can just do the tour with some lovely still images. Mm-hmm. If you want some more detail, like say, for example, it is a progress shot of quite a large building site, we can do a more detailed scan, which then gives you what's the CloudPoint data, which you can import into lots of different bits of software and into models and, you know, do sorts of comparison. And that's the thing, is it's very versatile.
Right. But how would that be cost effective for me? Let's say I'm a private landlord.
Yeah.
And I want to rent out my apartment down in Broadstairs, for example, for the summer.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be cost effective for me to engage you to come and do a 3D scan of my apartment? I mean, how much would that cost me?
Well, it's comparable to having a professional photographer come along and take some photographs. Mm-hmm. You're talking about that sort of price. I mean, for example, a three-bedroom house, you're talking, you know, sort of around about £380 mm-hmm. plus VAT. Right. So
you would get that back, you know, many times, wouldn't you? Because, it's a great sale.
Well, you could end up with a lot more viewings, which, of course, would put the price up, so you'll actually end up renting it for more money, I would suggest.
Mm. Well, also, it works really, really well with social media. So I don't claim I know much about it, but all of the algorithms, if you put some text on, you will get a certain amount of high ratings. Mm. You put a still image on, it will go up. You put a video on, you put anything that's interactive, and it just shoots you up to the top. So you will be close up there. So if there are two holiday lets in Broadstairs, and you go onto Facebook and you say, I want to stay somewhere in yours will be a lot higher instantly. Yes. We did one of the very first ones that we did was for a new development, and their website hits on their new development, they used to get anywhere between sort of 500 and 1,000 a month.
Mm-hmm.
We did a scan for them, they had 15,000 in the first week.
Amazing.
Like it's huge uplift.
It almost broke there. And they sold out, I think it was 70 properties, they sold them in something like a month. Mm-hmm. And also, again, we're talking about travelling and everything. The people who just want to have a look round and have no intention of buying have already had a look round. Mm. So when people are going to actually view the place, they're pre-qualified.
Yeah.
They're pretty much 90% going to go, we're going to buy this, we're going to put an offer in, or whatever it is. If, for example...
As a consumer, that makes perfect sense, doesn't it? I mean, I want to know as much about it before I actually have to invest any time to answer the questions I don't have.
Something you said earlier, actually, in conversation, Nick, which really struck a chord with me, was the story you were going to tell about an autistic boy and that experiential thing where, you know, if we are parents that have difficult children or different complex families, what a wonderful way to appreciate what the change is going to be. Tell us a little bit more about the story.
Well,
it's a great story.
It's something, it's a very specific story, but then it's kind of led on to us thinking about different things about just any space. So if you have any sort of disability, whether that may be physical or a mental disability or anything, or, you know, like we, you know, I don't know about you, but whenever I go out and see a disabled toilet, it's just not all, you know, disabilities are visible. If you're going to visit somewhere, you can see where the toilets are before you get there. You can see if they've got a ramp. You can see what hazards there may be for you for if you suffer with anxiety. This one particular thing that happened, so again, it was for an Airbnb scan we did for them to promote them. There was a couple, they had their son was severely I don't want to say severely because that sounds like a negative thing, so he was on high up on his Asperger's, and even just going to the supermarket, they'd have to have like a couple of days notice and prepare him, and because he would get very anxious, and, you know, understandably so. So they booked this. They'd never been away for more than two nights before. So they booked the two nights on and seeing that they had the tour that we produced for them. So the little boy had that on his iPad, and every night before he went to bed, he'd have a look around. So this was sort of a couple of weeks before, and then he'd say, "Oh, right, well, this is where I'm going to sleep. This is where mummy and daddy are going to sleep. This is where I'm going to put my teddies, and I can do this here, and this is where we're going there." And even on the journey up, which they said that the journey sometimes, they'd never been abroad with him. I think he was eight or nine. Even the journey could be stressful because he would be getting worried because he didn't know where he was. Mm. He was in the back of the car just going through the tour, looking at it. They turned up. They opened the front door. Usually he would be clinging to one of the parents for a good sort of couple of hours. He walked
probably
in.
Knew exactly where he was going.
Yeah, his
be
little
going.
Rucksack. Yeah, went in the bedroom, put his teddies on the bed, and went, right, where are we going now? And they said they had a fantastic, and now they're going to go we're only ever going to book somewhere that's got one of these tours now, and now maybe we can look at maybe going away for three nights, four nights, or whatever.
I think that's absolutely amazing. Mm. And
it's lovely. It's a really lovely thing fantastic. To. It's not, you know, I wouldn't necessarily use it as a marketing tool, but it's a really nice thing to kind of go, we've got this bit of technology that means you can look at things, but it's actually had a really positive impact on someone's life, which is just a really nice thing to have heard. And
so my mother went into a care home. She suffered from vascular dementia, and it was a real pig of a thing to find somewhere. But if care homes had this walk around,
absolutely,
it would give me so much comfort to be able to, as you say, see the room that she's going to be in, you know, and see the facilities, what they had. And it would be, I think what you're talking about is giving people comfort and confidence, which is slightly different to the commercial use of it, but it still has a commercial
but
outcome,
it's a nice
it?
Byproduct you know? Of it to kind of go, we've done a scan of this sort of this lovely building, but it's kind of going, well, that actually is a really nice side of it as well.
Well, I think it's something that before long will be used for virtually everything, because I think you're ahead of your time, Mr. Johnson, I have to say.
I think it's probably the first time that's ever been said to
me.
But
to know about you, Nick.
Especially with this haircut.
It's, yes, well...
that's an interesting point, though, because, I mean, it seems like such a no-brainer. How long has the technology been around for?
In this country, not very long. It's really big in the States.
Right.
And Far East, Singapore, around there, it's used an awful lot. Over here, it's not really caught on yet, but I mean, we do a lot of stuff now within construction. So we'll go through the four sort of stage life cycle of a building, sort of the tender process. So if someone's, you know, a fit out company's coming in to redo a building, we'll do the pre scan, then we'll do a couple of progress scans so they can do it, and then the completion scan, which is used for something called DLAPs. So, you know, like when you rent out a flat, they'll say, oh, you know, there's a stain on the carpet or whatever. They'll use that for that, because then, you know, the company may move out in 5 years, and then the fit out company's got to make good from that, and it gives a really good record of that. And I personally think within the next 5 years that will be part of the building life cycle that will be written in to every single building. It's just that we're kind of sort of a little bit ahead of the curve at the minute.
So if there'd been one at Grenfell,
well, things could have been very, very different. I mean, even down to nice. You know, we know a couple of people who are sort of dealing with that with someone within the marketing side of things. But something we've spoken to a local housing association here is scanning when they've finished all their cladding and everything, but is to scan the communal areas, and then from each single person's front door have a short YouTube video where literally I would just put a GoPro on my head and then walk the route out, because as humans we're very visual people. I mean, I'm sure all of us have been to, you know, travel lodge. I'm sure you go to better hotels than that, but us three, you know, and you look at the thing on the back of the door of the fire route, and you kind of go, I'm none the wiser. That makes no sense to me. I don't know, because I don't know where I am. I've just walked from reception to here. I don't know where. If you could visually sort of, you know, from your front door, watch a video of you, this is how you get out. This is how you get out in this example. Also,
airplanes. I mean, you know, any kind of, you know, when we all sit there not watching the safety video, you know, or the demonstration.
They do that on airlines.
Do they?
Some of them. Yeah.
And
I think there's something to be said about you don't have to read a whole load of technical jargon to get it. You can see it for yourself. And most of us, you know, well, a lot of us are visual. We get information and we decode it visually. If we have to labour over reading something, you know, we sort of...
Yeah, but if you can watch it. And the other thing is about having, as far as scanning the communicators, he's also sharing that with the local emergency services. So if you think, say, for example, something like Grenfell, where you had, you know, firefighters coming from all over London. Now, the local guys probably knew the building.
Right.
You've got someone coming from Bromley or from
really
Westminster. They've got no idea where, if they can if they can go, just shit, because all it is a web link. They go, we've got this going on. They can just share that web link with all of the firefighters. And on the way, you already know what the building's like.
I mean, virtual reality glasses, I think, are going to go hand in hand with this, aren't
they? Yes, absolutely. And it could be used as a training tool.
You know, the fire crew could be en route, you know, from a North London station. They don't know the area, but they can just put their VR goggles on. And as you say, they can actually be given a detailed plan of, you know, how they might get in and out of the building, how they might help people. And they can be looking at that en route in
real time.
Which will
save them a lot of time when they get there.
Well, also, the other thing is you kind of go for the, you know, even just the actual flats themselves. You kind of go, well, you're going to number 26, you know, there's someone in number 26 in the bedroom. Well, they don't know where the bedroom is.
No.
And looking in every single room may, A, time-wise, cause someone to be, or them being injured themselves. It's all about everyone.
So that could save a lot of time and planning for kind of crucial situations. But I'm just, I mean, Martin's really keen golfer. I mean, golf clubs could use it, couldn't they? Because you could show the clubhouse and the changing facilities and the driving range and the car park. And,
well, you could even scan
show
and walk
some
the course.
Holes. Mm-hmm. I was just going to say that. So if you could get some video stuff in there to say, okay, pick out a couple of holes, let's walk it.
Yeah,
you could use it at schools and stuff for like open evenings.
Oh, yes.
So for all
science
that kind of,
well, I remember. So
for facilities,
a majority of people that use what we do kind of just use it for real estate. Mm. But when I actually
it's
came
American,
across, yeah, well, because that's what it says on the website. But when I saw this, so I was looking. So I was working for Kate Spade, and she used to do all their store openings and just produce 360 images. I was kind of going, this, there must be something better than this. And then when I found this tech, the first thing that popped into my head was I could see a teacher in a primary school on an interactive whiteboard doing a virtual tour of the National History Museum, coming up to the Blue Whale, clicking the Blue Whale, and then something from the Blue Planet 2 comes up. And you kind of go, I saw it that big when I first saw it. So, you know, that's kind of, I think, where it can go.
Schools, I mean, you know, lessons.
You're fantastic learning.
You know, how to make...
spend all those hours on a coach travelling to the Natural History Museum.
Well, staring out the window.
Do you know what? By the end of this, there won't be any cars left on Kent Roads because we would have solved it all.
What's interesting about that, schools, is that, there, you know, in our society, there are, you know, there are also a mixed sort of, mixed society of kids from parents and families, etc., you know, from hugely successful families to ones that are on the breadline to those that find it difficult to sort of blended families and all that sort of thing. One of the most important things of all is knowing that our children are the next generation. And those that can be bothered will go and have a look at those schools to see what they're like and make an informed judgment, and others won't. But this is a wonderful way where, you, in privacy of your own home, you don't have to go anywhere. You can just have a look at the schools, make comparisons, and then decide. So I think this really helps people that, you know, or can't get to these places. So if you, you know, if you're on a low income and you can't get to a school, and it might be the right one for your child, you can see this without. And I think it's great value for money, because I think when people think about technology, they think about, first of all, oh, it's going to cost a lot of money. But actually, from what you say, it's just great value.
Yeah. Well, it is very cost effective. I mean, it depends on the detail that you need on the scan. So there is a sort of sliding scale up. But, you know, if the example I gave you, Martin, about the cost, that would be for, you know, say the floor plans, the walkthrough.
Which is all I would need. Yeah.
Which is all you would need for that, exactly. Yeah. So if you're a construction company, then there's, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's what we don't just say, this is what it is and this is how much it is. And, you know, we kind of go, well, what do you want? We try and tailor it to the end user. So we're not going to sell somebody something that they don't need.
But I love those hot buttons as well. You know, like, I mean,
I mean,
I've got some friends staying at Christmas and we're going to France and having their house and they're having our house. I mean, they got the short straw there, by the way. They live in a fabulous villa with a heated swimming pool in the south of France.
And you'll drink all
their
wine.
Are you sure that you're going and you're not part of the new series of Wife Swap?
We don't. Anyway, but I was thinking, God, I'm going to have to write instructions for telling them how to turn the boiler on and, you know, where the heating thermostat is and all this kind of stuff. I'm thinking, that's a nightmare. I've got to write all this out. But, of course, I wouldn't have to, would I? I could say, oh, just have a look at our website here. And it's got all the buttons, you know, it's got all the kind of the hot buttons for how to do this.
You wouldn't even need to do that. All you would do literally just, if you just WhatsApp or text them the link, it automatically opens up in a browser on your phone and it's extensive. And the really nice thing about it with the tech is it's not difficult to know how to navigate, for want of a better expression. Intuitive. Yeah, you're already using it because when you look at it on your phone, you swipe left and you swipe right. You're already doing it before you know you're doing it.
Say you walked into a hospital. I mean, it's like a visual sat-nav, isn't it? You go into hospital and you don't know where the hell to go. Mm. But if a hospital got its act together and could do something like this, the angst...
Knowing where you're going and
X-ray department. Oh, where's the X-ray department? Exactly. I'll log on to the NHS East Kent Trust, look at the QEQM, and there it is.
Well, I remember this.
Sorry?
Are you listening?
I did this with my mum. Why'd she have to go for something?
I found it very easy the other day. They've got very good signs. Okay. Traditional does work as well.
Well, yeah,
but if you
absolutely.
Think about something the size of Guy's and St Thomas's, it's mahoosive.
I had to take my mum to hospital, and I didn't know she's not, you know, she wasn't walking particularly great at the time, and I was like, do I put her in a wheelchair? Yeah. Do we walk? Do we get the lift? Yes. Do we walk? Where is it? How far is it?
Yeah.
You know, even when there's a sign, you kind of go, well, that's all very well saying that it's there, but suddenly you're in
train station
green zone, which is, you know, in a different county.
You can update things quite easily as well.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, so you could, no if you, say, for example, you like, the room that we're in here, if, say, for example, something happened in this room, let's hope it doesn't today. but say, for example, it's redecorated or whatever. You wouldn't have to rescan the whole space. You would literally just come and do this one room and then it would just be sort of updated on the onto the thing. So,
Nick, I just want to move it on because we haven't got long left.
Okay.
Because you do traditional photography as well.
I do indeed,
and I do want to talk about that very briefly because I myself was the proud recipient of a headshot that you did for me. You may not remember.
I do remember.
You do
base
remember.
Point
at Base Point in Chatham. Chatham. Yes. Chatham, darling.
Oh, sorry.
For me at LinkedIn Live.
Is that,
actually.
About 4 years ago, I think, and I'd just come back off holiday from Sicily, so I was looking at my best, which is why I haven't actually changed that picture, because
in the past
I've
without
never
the ginger
found
hair.
One as good as that since.
Oh, well,
so
thank
I
you very
still
much.
Use it, and I think I'm just about recognisable.
He must have... yeah, he must have touched you up a treat, I would say.
I think I might have had the fisherman's sock on that day.
So tell us very quickly the kind of commissions that you get involved with on that level.
So
is it personal and commercial?
It's more on the commercial side. Mm-hmm. I mean, over my career, I've done it over the years. Mainly now I work for quite a few sort of public sector. So I do a lot of work in housing for a few local councils. And also this sort of business profile picture. So I think I met Rebecca at Brian's networking at BBN and did a really nice shoot. She's an osteopath and medial hypnotherapist.
Yeah.
Apologies, right. Rebecca, if I've got that incorrect.
Rebecca Oliver.
And, you know, what I did for her, we did a shoot. We had sort of, it's only a couple of hours on a Sunday afternoon and just did as many different pictures. So now she's got a huge amount of collateral that she can use on her social media. She can shoot near the website. You know, she could use them on leaflets or whatever. So, you know, it's not just turning up and doing a headshot.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know,
thinking about the business.
Yeah, I mean, we met for a coffee sort of about 6 weeks before we did the shoot for a couple of hours to learn about her business, but also to learn about her, to, you know, who she was, why she is where she is with her business and what she was doing. And I do this with, you know, everyone, you know, it's not just I just turn up and take some pictures. I want to learn about the person and the business, because then that's when you get that to come through in the pictures, because you don't want to just take a few shots of someone.
We are going to have to kind of close it there, unfortunately.
Absolutely.
Surely not.
But we've just got time for you to give everybody your contact information before we say goodbye.
Yes, so...
where can we find you?
We can find me, usually under a bridge somewhere, crying. best places to look is either www.immersive3d.co.uk. There's sort of three or four sample tools you can have a look at, and then all of our contact details are on there, so that's the best place to find us.
And Nick Johnson on LinkedIn.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, brilliant. Nick, Anita, thank you so much for coming today. It's been fabulous.
You.
I can't believe we've run out of time already. Brian, you're not going to be here for the next show because you'll be sunning yourself in Cyprus.
Yes, I will. I shall be sunning the bod in Paphos.
But I will be here with the wonderful Tracy Westall. So we look forward to tuning in again in 2 weeks' time. And in the meantime, have a fabulous couple of weeks in business.
And 4 weeks in my case, so...
Thanks very much. Thanks for listening.
See
bye-bye.
See you on the other side.
Channel 2 Talk